Welcome to the 2019 Volume 1, Issue 1, Winter Book Symposium, podcast edition of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, published April 4, 2025. All contents are protected under the Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International Deed. For citations, notes, and references, please refer to the printed articles at www.jpeonline.org. Book Symposium, Table of Contents. Furtak, Rick A., 2019. Precy, Knowing Emotions, Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 1, Number 1, 98-105, https://doi.org/10.33497/v1i1.42. D'Souza, Ronald, 2019. Emotional Knowledge and the Emotional A Priori. Comments on Rick A. Furtak's Knowing Emotions. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 1, Number 1, 106-112, https://doi.org/10.33497/vita v1i1.27. Bisecker Dave, 2019. Emotional Cognitivism Without Representationalism. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 1, Number 1, 113-122, https://doi.org/10.33497/vita v1i1.35. Gallegos Francisco, 2019. What are emotions for? From Effective Epistemology to Effective Ethics. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 1, Number 1, 123-134, https://doi.org/10.33497/vita v1i1.33. Furtak, Rick. A. 2019. Knowing Emotions. Replies to D'Souza, Bisecker, and Gallegos. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 1, Number 1. 135-145. https://doi.org/10.33497/v1i1.30.
Article 1. Precy. Knowing Emotions. Truthfulness and Recognition in Effective Experience. By Rick A. Furtak. Axioms in philosophy are not axioms until they are proved upon our pulses. John Keats. Letter of May 3, 1818 to John Hamilton Reynolds. If you stare at the sun for a moment and then look away, you are likely to experience a phenomenon known as an afterimage. The image does not even purport to show you what is the case. It is devoid of cognitive significance and not at all oriented toward revealing the truth. Although I accept that emotions are best understood as corporeal phenomena, I do not think this entails that they are as meaningless as afterimages. How, then, can we do adequate justice both to the embodied character of emotions and to their intentionality, or to what they can show us about the world? This is one way of stating the question, which is the starting point of my book, Knowing Emotions. If the heart does indeed have reasons of its own, which are unknowable through merely dispassionate rationality, then there must be something distinctive about emotions or effective awareness in general, which enables this mode of experience to aspire toward truthful disclosure. So how is this possible? In order for us to take our emotions seriously as potentially revealing significant truths, we need to address the claims of those who argue that we should not take them seriously. The main arguments used to cast doubt on the idea that emotions have epistemic import can be classified into two groups: those that appeal to empirical findings and those that make use of conceptual thought experiments. I deal with these in that order. First, some philosophers have pointed toward neuroscientific findings as evidence that emotions arise prior to higher cognitive activity. This is based upon a widely publicized extrapolation from research by Joseph Ledoux on startled rats. In his more recent work, however, Ledoux has repudiated this interpretation and stated his agreement with what he calls cognitive theories of emotion, such as those espoused by other neuroscientists like Edmund Rolls, 2014, Luis Pessoa, 2010, and Antonio Damasio, 1994, among others. An emerging consensus, then, would seem to indicate that fear, in fact, cannot occur only in virtue of activity in the lower, non-cognitive areas of the brain. This realization, however, has yet to receive much notice in the philosophy of emotion. Thus, I intend to provide a corrective against a common misconception, turning to research from social psychology, including such classic studies as Stepper and Strack, 1993, and Strack, Martin and Stepper, 1988, as well as more recent work such as Wagemakers et al., 2016. I conclude that physiological agitation is a necessary, although not sufficient, condition of effective arousal. Typically, the feeling of being in a particular bodily state is a crucial aspect of our emotional experience. This includes a sense of one's own facial expression, one's proprioceptive condition, one's pulse rate, whether or not one's skin is flushed, and so forth. The role played by all of this in human emotion is not accidental by any means, but must be included in any complete account. Yet if the felt occurrence of somatic conditions such as these could single-handedly induce an emotional response, that is, if a fear-like pattern of bodily commotion were able without any sense of danger to make a person afraid, then once again we might have reason to disassociate fear from any kind of intelligent activity. I think this would be a mistake. Taking on the sort of thought experiments intended to show that an emotion such as fear can persist despite our full awareness that what frightens us is harmless, I defend the claim that a person's feelings are seldom, if ever, entirely recalcitrant in the sense of simply not answering to reason. We should not assume that the person afflicted by phobic fear has exactly the same beliefs about the feared object as do those of us who feel totally unafraid of it. Rather, emotional upheavals can manifest our deepest beliefs about reality and value, allowing significant recognitions to register to hit home with us. Even when a particular emotion is not an accurate recognition but a misconstrual, it is nevertheless a potentially world-revealing phenomenon which stakes a claim to being true. Through our emotions, things appear to be a certain way. Once we reach the middle chapter of knowing emotions, I have drawn the conclusion that regarding non-value neutral issues, intellectual activity without effective feeling is profoundly lacking in its ability to inform us about these significant matters of concern. Moreover, we should accept that our capacity for emotional apprehension is embodied in quite specific ways. The type of recognition that an emotion incorporates is inherent in its phenomenal character, in such a way that how it feels to get afraid or to grieve is inextricably entwined with what we are fearing or what we are grieving the loss of. One sense in which the heart has its own form of intelligence is that what our emotions disclose would be otherwise inaccessible to us. I argue that we do not know what it means that danger is at hand, or that a loved one has died and is gone forever, if we are unmoved by this information. Our fear is either an emotional awareness of an actual threat or a false feeling that something is threatening when it is not. And our grief is not a disembodied thought of loss tacked onto a mere somatic agitation. Instead, the recognition of the loss is internal to our felt state of emotion. Such recognitions of personally relevant meanings, via the effective experiences of grasping or cognizing those meanings, are potentially truthful perceptions. It is through our emotions that we have a sense of reality and an understanding of what life means. This is why they are an indispensable way of gaining insight about both self and world. Episodes of emotion arise against a background in which significant features of our lives and our surroundings already matter to us. Once we care about something, we are liable to have a variety of different emotions about it in reaction to events pertaining to whatever we care about. For instance, if you love a child, this renders you liable to experience relief and perhaps gratitude when he or she arrives home safely despite the icy roads. Your concern for the child is a long-standing disposition with a specific focus. Before his or her safe arrival, you felt afraid and worried due to this concern. I explain this by saying that your care disposes you to feel worry, fear, relief, and gratitude. Affective dispositions establish the realm of things which count and exist for us, to employ a phrase from Merleau-Ponty. Referring to these dispositions collectively as emotional a priori, I try to clarify how it is that love, care, or concern is a condition of possibility for revealing axiologically salient features of the world. When a person loves or cares about someone or something, he or she becomes vulnerable to a whole range of emotions insofar as what he or she cares about is impacted in various ways, for better or worse. To leave the emotional a priori out on account would be to render our affective experiences utterly mysterious. The theoretical fiction of a flat world in which nothing commands our attention is one that could appear only to a person who is completely devoid of love or care. Unless we suffer from a severely disabling condition, what we meet with and experience are things and possibilities that seem real and significant. The emotional a priori allows us to perceive features of our surroundings that are not of our own making, but that are not manifestly evident apart from our affective receptivity either. I compare our capacity for love, care, or concern to the aperture in a camera, since it opens our eyes to value and gives us access to what is beyond us. By taking an interest in elements of our environment, most emphatically the existence of anything we care about for its own sake, we ground a meaningful world of concern that is illuminated by final ends and contours of axiological valence. Once I have taken an interest in the interest of another person, I now care about whatever she loves. This makes me effectively disposed to take notice of what might affect her emotionally. In the process, I broaden and expand my world, finding a significance in things which is not an illusory fabrication, but which could not become visible except to the structure of a passionately engaged subject. So a child who struggles with language might have creative or scientific gifts that only a loving and perceptive parent could discern and encourage. This must be distinguished from projecting false qualities onto a person. The world is not a value-neutral screen onto which we superimpose non-existent properties. There are personally significant truths that we recognize in experiencing emotions, including when we are seen with loving eyes. We may have a grounding attunement to our friends, our pets, our hometown or the valley where we live, to traditions and ideals, and to goals such as social justice or the creation of beauty in a certain art form. In each case, what we are oriented toward is a concrete particular, something whose life, either literal or metaphorical, we wish to be thriving. And it is precisely the distinctive peculiarity of our emotional perspective that brings these aspects of the world into our view. In this manner, the realm of what has the power to move us emotionally rises up like an island out of a sea of indifferent being. In the words of Max Scheler, these islands are demarcated with highly individualized intricacy. Yet in my final chapter, Attunement and Perspectival Truth, I suggest that we can acquire insight through our pervasive moods, our temperaments, and our idiosyncratic affective outlooks. A depressive, languid, or apathetic mood is not just a private state, but is simultaneously a feeling that the world affords no opportunities to become meaningfully engaged, that enticing possibilities are unavailable to us. Our default assumption should not be that a mood is about nothing. Fortunately, there is increased appreciation and a growing body of evidence to confirm that indiscriminately maximizing good moods can actually impair cognition, and that even depressive states may be truthful or reasonable in that they capture important truths and accurately depict actual states of affairs in the world. Thus, I follow Heidegger in claiming that there could be a particular truth or manifestness that lies in every attunement. Even the outlook demanded by theoretical research is not the absence of mood, but one way of being tuned into the world. It is a pity to be trapped too exclusively in a depressive mood, because the way the world seems to us when we are depressed is not the only way it is. Due to the multifaceted and pluralistic realm of value that we inhabit, Nietzsche famously remarks that a diversity of perspectives and effective interpretations are useful for knowledge. At any instant, an episode of emotion can erupt into our awareness, altering our mood and making us aware of another side of the truth. Right now, that to which we are attuned is part of a larger reality, glimpsed from a vantage point which itself is partial. There are more significant truths than could ever be known emotionally from one standpoint. When we speak about the realm of what is effectively recognized by any one specific person, what is at stake isn't just the world as it can be known by human beings universally, or as it appears to those within a particular society, for whom it will have culturally shared features. Instead, we must appreciate that the world apprehended by each of us in his or her distinct way is still recognizably the world, one in which we perceive from a specific angle and view things in a certain light. Each of us can know only so much of what is emotionally knowable, so a plurality of differing affective subjects is required in order to apprehend more facets of the many-sided world. I employ the notion of temperament to signify a person's entire affective standpoint, her concerns and way of caring, her characteristic attunements, as well as her manner of responding emotionally to particular situations. Our temperament never becomes an object that we can observe because it is that through which we look. It is disclosed in a way that the significance of our existence shows up for us emotionally. I conclude the book by claiming that our patterns of affective cognitions must always be open to revision and change, thereby making emotional truthfulness or authenticity into a regulative ideal, one toward which we must continuously strive. Article 2, Emotional Knowledge and Emotional A Priori. Comments on Rick. Hey, Furtak's Known Emotions by Ronald D'Souza. Furtak's book is an enjoyable read. For much of it, I found myself nodding in agreement. We all know that emotions involve physiological processes and somehow provide us with information both about ourselves and the world. But how? Furtak has set out to explain how those somatic agitations we feel when we are effectively moved might actually contribute to the ways that the emotions inform us about how things are a world of concern. 40. It is a worthy goal. In the following comments, I will raise no major objection to Furtak's main line of argument. My questions are essentially requests for clarification. They focus on three key expressions. First, the unified character of emotional agitation and intentionality. Second, the unique mode of cognition claim for emotions. And third, the emotional a priori. Unified, Furtak repeatedly makes use of a word often favored by exponents of enactivism. The word is unified. It occurs first on pages 19 to 20. The somatic and the cognitive are not two utterly discrete components of emotion that are mysteriously joined or correlated. Rather, they are conceptually separable aspects of one unified response. The thought recurs on page 47. Emotions are unified experiences and not combinations of bodily agitation plus intentionality. On pages 54, 67, 73, 93, and citing the enactivist-activist column Betty, on page 169. What unified means, however, is to be gleaned only from its contraries, not two utterly discrete components, not agitation plus intentionality, not as hybrids, 52. But what is the difference between being conceptually separable and utterly discrete? In a single event, we may experience different properties. A farewell can be bittersweet. The bitterness and the sweetness are distinct and certainly conceptually separable, but perhaps not utterly discrete, not just bitterness plus sweetness. For in a unified experience of bittersweetness, each modifies the other, much as a patch of color looks different next to different hues. But bitterness and sweetness relate to different aspects of the event. The sweetness is about the tenderness experienced in the farewell. The bitterness is an immediate prospect of separation. Are agitation and intentionality united like bitterness and sweetness? Probably not. The agitation and the intentionality are not just properties of a single event that happen to be simultaneously experienced. Emotions typically involve a felt sense of bodily agitation, 33, which agitation is inherently related to what it is about, 21. So perhaps what unifies them is that they collaborate on a single process, the unfolding of the story that is the emotion. What goes on in the brain of an emotional person is just one part of a larger story, 37. It still seems true, however, that the conceptually separable aspects of the unified experience make distinctive contributions to the process as a whole and deserve to be examined separately. So I'm still unclear about what the slogan unified experience excludes. Here is one way the agitation and the intentionality might be linked. Perhaps fear, as an apprehension of danger, causes, or essentially consists in, on some views of emotion, Scarantino 2014, an action tendency to flight or avoidance that would bring out how a given emotion-specific formal object both causally explains and justifies a given range of behavior and suggests that the unity we seek derives from a functional coherence on emotional process. But it would be no reason to think the unified experience must be falsified by being analyzed into its components. Emotional knowing. A central doctrine of Furtak's book is announced early on and repeated passim. It is because what we come to know through our emotions could not be adequately grasped by any other means that the emotions embody a distinctive mode of cognition, 103. First, the because. Is it meant to express a logical entailment or a causal relation? Either way, it's not clear why a single object couldn't be grasped by distinct modes of cognition. I may learn about some recent event by reading the paper or by hearing about it on the radio. I might come to know that a cello is being played before me either by sight or by ear. Are those not different modes of knowing in the relevant sense? Why not? What counts as a mode of knowledge? And how should we identify the class of objects each mode provides? Although Furtak asserts that emotions are a distinct mode of apprehension, 74, providing exclusive access to otherwise inaccessible, 103, objects, he endorses a standard view of rational emotions as whose targets fit their formal object. Fear is apt, for example, if the thing feared is actually dangerous, 13. It follows that fear can be misplaced. An emotion can be evaluated in terms of its truthfulness, 83. If so, there must be some non-emotional way of assessing whether something is dangerous or not. If not, what could count against the fear's truthfulness? If any other mode of knowledge could apprehend only different objects, they can neither confirm nor refute the disclosure achieved by the emotion. That seems to cast doubt on the claim that fear affords any sort of exclusive knowledge of danger. But although unaware of any current agitation, I fear I may have missed Furtak's point. Let me try to make progress by looking at two models inspired by sensory faculties. First, sight and touch seem to exemplify distinct modes of cognition. They afford, respectively, knowledge of colors or of textures, inaccessible by any other means. But what is not otherwise disclosed by each sensory channel is merely what they feel like, not what they are. Many other objects are apprehended both by sight and touch. A bottle, say, or its position relative to a glass. On that model, a distinct mode of knowledge might define a class of subjectively experienced qualia tied to a specific sensory channel. It could not provide exclusive access to any interpersonally available facts. It's not obvious, moreover, that any single channel of information such as sight or touch could provide objective knowledge of any reality independent of our specific sensory capacities. An objective fact should, by definition, be accessible in several different ways. The consilience of different lines of evidence is widely viewed as a criterion of objective reality, Wilson, 1998. A second sensory analogy might be drawn with Frank Jackson's Mary, the color expert deprived from birth of color experience, Jackson, 1986. Mary knows everything there is to know about color, physical, psychological, and neural. When F. Earth exposed to the experience of color, does she acquire new knowledge? Intuitions differ. One issue is whether what Mary discovers, if anything, is a further truth about the world, what yellow is, or merely a fact about herself. What it feels like to her when she sees that color, all objective properties of which she already knows. Now imagine Miriam, who has never felt fear, but who is well aware of the meaning of danger as a parameter computed on the basis of probability and extent of proximate harm. She also knows, without having experienced it, that fear is a normal way of gauging the value of that parameter in a single unified experience. But since Miriam is perfectly capable of working out that value on the basis of facts about the world, her experience of fear doesn't constitute her only mode of knowing it. It merely constitutes one simple, non-inferential way of finding it out. The new knowledge she has just acquired is just a sense of what danger feels like to her. In both Mary's and Miriam's cases, the new knowledge, if any, is purely subjective. Knowledge of that elusive philosophical quarry, a quaily. In Miriam's case, what's new is merely how it feels to care about danger. It's about her, not about any objective fact in the world. The objective danger which fear made her aware was there all along, and she could perfectly well have known it. The emotion is merely the attitude she takes towards it, the emotional a priori. Miriam's attitude depends, of course, on what she cares about. Furtak argues that what grounds every attitude specific to a situation can be conceptualized as an emotional a priori. This is the topic of my third set of questions. I find the notion of an emotional a priori very intriguing, but the more I think about it, the less I understand it. Furtak asks, what are the enabling conditions that make us capable of having emotions? Also, how do these conditions ground effective experience as a capacity that is potentially capable of revealing something true? 103-4. His answer posits an emotional a priori, the set of background affective dispositions such as love, care, and concern that grounds our whole emotional life, 108. The metaphor of grounding is complemented with notions of basicness and of foundation. When I refer to basic affective dispositions, I mean that they have a foundational place in the emotional life of human beings 108. But foundations could be material, causal, logical, or epistemic, so it's not immediately clear what is being claimed. Furtak identifies the emotional a priori with love, care, and concern 108. Let me focus for a moment on those three terms. The first seems to be in a different category from the other two. A notable feature of love is that almost any emotion can be a manifestation of it. This has led some philosophers to argue that love is not, contrary to what almost everyone agrees, 107, an emotion. Instead, it is a syndrome, D'Souza 2015, Pismany and Prince 2017. Furtak prefers to speak of it as a grounding condition. But while other cares and concerns can also give rise to or ground a potentially unlimited variety of emotional episodes, that does not stem from their specific character. It merely reflects the generality of those terms. Care and concern are the most nearly synonymous terms, as well as the broadest in scope. What we love is a subset of what we care about. The range of things I care about presumably just exactly coincides with the set of my concerns, 113. Sure enough, I will not respond emotionally to what is completely irrelevant to anything in that set. But to assimilate care and concern to an emotional a priori is misleading, for the a priori is usually taken to be, by definition, independent of experience. And that is not true of our concerns. Experience teaches us to care about some things and cease to care about some others. So while it is certainly true, if not downright trivial, that our emotions respond only to what bears on our concerns, it remains obscure how the latter grounds the former. In some cases, we come to care about one thing on the basis of caring about another. I may be quite indifferent to the state of traffic on Route 401 until the day a subway strike forces me to drive. In such cases, my interest is instrumental. It is a means to serve an existing concern with getting to my office. In other cases, what is F. Earth valued instrumentally can come to be valued for itself. Money, for example. We can also come to value something intrinsically because it has activated our reward system, despite not figuring in any deliberation about what might be instrumentally relevant. Could the emotional a priori be identified with the functionality of the brain's reward system, which entrains new desires, Schroeder 2004? That might fit in with the idea that the emotional a priori is supposed to enable emotions rather than be identified with any specific emotion. But again, I don't think this is Furtak's kind of grounding. Another approach might focus on our capacity to respond to basic needs, such as a capacity to feel pleasure and pain, or the needs represented by the four Fs, or Panksepp's four primary emotional systems of coordinated physiological, hormonal, behavioral, and phenomenological activity, Panksepp 2000. But those sound too much like answers to a scientific question. Furtak seemed concerned with a more metaphysical sort of grounding. Yet another approach might be inspired by the fact that when we attempt to justify or explain our emotions and desires, we construct chains that necessarily end in something we just want or just care about. Those are basic, in a sense analogous to that of Danto's basic actions, Danto 1965. Just as not everything we do can be done by doing something else, so not everything we want can be wanted for the sake of or as a means to something else. That doesn't mean they are inexplicable. Just that further explanations must appeal to a different layer of theory, such as the physiological or hormonal, that lacks the evaluative or normative import of emotional states. Though I would find this plausible, I again think it cannot be what Furtak has in mind, for he claims to view it as inexact to claim that either desires or goals are grounding conditions of our emotional responses, 117. I remain unpersuaded of that inexactitude, however. It is certainly true that our emotions relate to our concerns. But what are our concerns, if not those things we have desires and emotions about? In a trivial sense, anything we do or feel attests to the fact that we had a disposition, so to act or feel. But I can't see what light is shed by pausing in order of priority, logical, causal, or chronological, that places cares and concerns before any specific emotions and desires. Conclusion. Accordingly, I am unable to identify Furtak's emotional a priori with any of the interpretations of that phrase that I have been able to construct. Neither has he convinced me that emotions exclusively reveal or disclose facts about the world. To be sure, Emotions can tip us off about the state of our environment and often prepare us to act on what we know. But they don't bring us exclusive knowledge of anything objectively existing independently of our needs and desires. And while emotions do manifest attitudes, those attitudes need be neither prior nor posterior to concerns to which they relate. Article 3, Emotional Cognitivism Without Representationalism, by Dave Bisecker. For those of us living lives that are even remotely human, one hardly needs to turn to proofs to manufacture illustrations of the themes that animate Rick Anthony Furtak's Knowing Emotions. Here's one which strikes a deeply personal note. While I'm out with her on a walk, I pause to let my old girl Siggy roll around in the grass. Seeing the obvious delight she takes in the activity, I too am filled with joy and come to think about how important she has become to me and also how I will grieve when she is no longer around. Though perhaps a little sentimental, there should be nothing unfamiliar about the case of emotional knowing just described. It is one of those mundane, everyday moments that, nevertheless, make life itself worth living, at least for somebody like me, if you are unable to comprehend it. Indeed, if you are unable to relate to it in any way whatsoever, then truly I weep for you. I would suspect that your humanity is somewhat diminished, whether due to physical or psychological trauma, an inability to synthesize just the right cocktail of neurotransmitters, or the bad luck to grow up in a wrong environment. Your capacity to enjoy a fully human life has been compromised. You need help, and I imagine the primary focus of this symposium would agree. But how are we best to understand emotions, such as those spoken of in the foregoing vignette? Clearly, emotions form an integral part of our cognitive being. Any account of the emotions that drives a Cartesian, note the scare quotes, wedge between the emotional and the intellectual must be rejected. My perception of Siggy in the grass sparks my joy, which in turn leads to an awareness that she is a vital part of my being. Crucially, these connections are not just causal, they are justificatory as well. My joy is rationally permitted by witnessing hers, and that joy in turn justifies my belief that she is now significant to me. Indeed, without a substantial body of such effective engagement, I could not reasonably come to have such a thought at all. Thus, I find myself in broad agreement with one of Furtak's central claims. Our emotions are primary, though I wouldn't go so far as to say exclusive, means by which we come to such thoughts. At the same time, however, the joy I feel must be kept distinct from the otherwise dispassionate thoughts that it provokes and justifies, as well as the otherwise dispassionate thoughts that provoke and justify it. I might feel joy at Siggy rolling around the grass, indeed, be consciously caught up in it, and yet fail to conclude that she is important to me. Somebody witnessing my rapture can come to that conclusion independently, and then be in position to tell me something important about myself. Though subjective, there's nothing essentially private about our thoughts and feelings. We manifest them in our reactions all the time. Moreover, somebody witnessing my joy could well use it to challenge any commitments I might have made not to cultivate such relations. For someone who expresses such disdain for animals, a friend might chide, "You sure seem to show a whole lot of concern for that dog and its well-being." If indeed I were steadfastly committed to renouncing the thought that Siggy could have any special significance to me, then I should perhaps take steps to suppress such joy. And it turns out that I can achieve such a turn of the heart, at least to a point. Just as our emotions rationally influence our intellectual conceptions, our intellectual commitments can exert some measure of rational control over our emotions. They emotions are not, as non-cognitivists would have it, mere somatic agitations or disruptions arising from the body that serve merely to intrude upon our consciousness. Furtak, 2018-11. They are part of its very fabric. The challenge, as William James so famously put it in What is an Emotion?, is to acknowledge and understand just how much our mental life is knit up with our corporeal frame. James 1884-201. Quoted by Furtak, 2018-17. I don't think there is anything in these remarks so far to which Furtak would lodge any great objection. Indeed, these are just the sorts of observations that motivate the bulk of his broadly cognitivist account of the emotions, which stresses a degree to which our emotional and cognitive lives are intertwined or inextricably related to one another, 82. If there are any significant further pieces that go missing in the short description of my emotional entanglement with Siggy, then I would like to hear them. For I worry that Furtak presents us with an account that overstates the connection between emotional states and the contents of the thoughts to which they are rationally connected. Furtak's expressed aim is to find some sort of middle ground that acknowledges both the cognitive and corporeal dimensions of our emotional involvement. On the one hand, he wholly endorses the idea that emotional feeling is essentially somatic or corporeal. At the same time, however, he insists that the emotional bodily sensations are not merely agitations of the body. They also point beyond themselves, 11, to carry significant information about our lived environment, 55. The somatic agitation we feel when we are trembling with fear, for example, is not a mere sensation, but a felt apprehension of danger. And to feel pangs of guilt is to undergo what might be called a thoughtful bodily agitation. That is how emotions involve the living body in referring to persons, ideals, memories, possibilities, events, and so on. This demands an account of human emotions, not as hybrids of rational judgment somehow conjoined with irrational corporeal commotion, but as feelings through which we apprehend what is significant to us. 55. It is this crucial feature of affective experience which Furtak stresses has unfortunately been left out of most accounts. 45. Indeed, this insistence upon the intentionality of our emotions is particularly strident. As Furtak sees it, our emotions reveal to us aspects of reality that are wholly unavailable without emotional engagement. Emotions constitute a distinctive means of apprehension in which something comes to be realized or perceived that could not become known in any other way. 74. Specifically, only by means of emotional engagement do we perceive meaning in life. By them alone are we capable of recognizing the value or significance of anything whatsoever. 3. Furtak, thus, characterizes emotions as perceptions of significance. 82. Emphasis mine. To become passionately agitated is to have one's attention drawn to something that is experienced as axiologically prominent. 76. It is at this stage that Furtak tells us that in order for us to acknowledge that human emotions are not irrational disturbances, but potentially truth-revealing phenomena, our account of cognition may need to be broadened. 74. I would agree with this assessment that the proper integration of the emotional and the dispassionately intellectual will force a revision in the traditional conception of cognition. However, I would question the manner in which Furtak pursues this strategy. Furtak's move is to expand the range of states that can be said to have intentional content to include somatic feelings, and also to expand the range of intentional contents that may so be felt. However, when speaking of such content, Furtak draws upon a tradition that insists upon understanding intentionality as aiming, like an arrow, toward the truth. Such an understanding leads him in turn to conceptual content in representational terms, that is, in terms of truth and reference. For Furtak, intentional states purport to be about items in the world, and they represent those items as being a certain way. Hence, Furtak feels compelled to talk about the purported objects to which my emotions are directed, and the worldly conditions of those objects by which those emotions are to be deemed correct or incorrect, appropriate or inappropriate. Consider again my joy at Siggy's rolling around in the grass. According to Furtak, the fact that this joy plugs in so tightly with my otherwise dispassionate intellectual conceptions shows that it must have cognitive or conceptual content of its own. If you were to ask me what I'm joyful about or what I'm taking joy in, my joy clearly centers around Siggy. The question then is, what exactly does my emotional reaction say about her? How does it represent her? While my joy is prompted and to a large degree justified by my seeing her rolling about the grass, Furtak denies that that is a true intentional content of my emotion, for I could come to knowledge and observation that Siggy is lolling about the grass without taking any such joy in it. Indeed, it could spark an altogether different emotion, a jolt of anger, annoyance, or fear, perhaps, depending upon other auxiliary states of mind. Instead, the true, or perhaps deep, content of the emotion, the content that in it alone reveals to me, is that she is significant to me. My emotion thus reveals to me an antecedent reality that I could not be in touch with without any such emotional engagement. Here, Furtak repeatedly speaks of our emotional engagement as if it were akin to more familiar perceptual processes. The fact that love makes us aware of the significance of things does not necessarily entail that this significance is projected onto the world by our own minds. Our capacity for love, care, concern, or interest can function more like the aperture in a camera, opening for the eye of the beholder so that he or she has access to what is truly out there beyond us. 128. Through emotions we perceive or apperceive. 74. A realm of subjective significance that is antecedent to our representation or cognition of that reality. Emotions reveal meaningful truths. 123. By playing a world-disclosing role. Opening us up to an awareness of what is meaningful. 127. Firtak's commitment to an emotional representationalism modeled upon perception thus leads him to a rather strong form of axiological realism. 132. According to which our emotional responses are answerable to a world outside our mind. 145. However, this axiological realism strikes me as less attractive than a simpler and more phenomenologically accurate alternative. It might well be true that if I didn't feel as I do towards Siggy, then I wouldn't or shouldn't think of her as significant to me. But that is because those feelings serve in part to constitute such significance, rather than representing or indicating it. If I didn't feel as I do, then the significance wouldn't truly exist, and I shouldn't claim that it did. In this connection, think of folk who falsely, perhaps even self-deceptively, profess their love of someone or something. This suggests to me that the indispensability of emotions or the proper recognition of significance does not, as Firtak would have it, show that the emotions represent such significance. Rather than emotions constituting the recognition of significance, it strikes me as more apt to say that our emotional reactions constitute the state of affairs that is subsequently recognized in dispassionate thought. Firtak appears to dismiss this alternative as counterintuitively projectivist. 139. But it is aptly characterized a projectivist only if one insists that emotions have some representational content that gets projected out onto the world. 94. There is no such content to project. Instead, the emotion should be viewed as a constituent feature of the fact about myself that comes to be recognized, and without which there will be much less rational basis for such recognition. Again, it is Firtak's insistence upon representationalism that seems to get in the way of what strikes me as a more phenomenologically accurate Jamesian alternative. It is reasonable to think that truth is a norm that runs beyond justification. For an attitude to be of a type that genuinely aims at the truth, then one should be able to find instances of that attitude that are wholly justified, yet nevertheless fall short of revealing the truth. That, above anything else, is a challenge facing Firtak's account. He draws such a tight connection between feelings of emotion and emotional truths that they allegedly represent that it becomes very hard to see how one could have a fully justified emotion without it also being true. Rather than meeting this challenge head-on, I would contend that the revision to our conception of cognition that the emotions demand is not one of expanding the range of states that can be said to have intentional content which aims at the truth. Rather, we need to expand our conception of cognition to encompass states that do not aim at truth, perhaps including some that don't have any representational function at all. Emotions are prime candidates to occupy this territory, which is generally occluded by traditional representationalism. Here, it is worth pointing out that in recent philosophy of mind and language, there has been a renewed interest in accounts that suggest that various forms of indicative thought and discourse are nevertheless not really descriptive or aimed at truth. Vast swaths of our thought and talk generate what Price, 2013, calls location problems, that are locating out in the non-discursive world facts or truth makers to correspond to the correctness of such thought and talk. Hence, the recent proliferation of various kinds of quasi-realist or expressivist accounts that aim to make sense of our thought and talk about morality, causality, modality, probability, semantics, conditionals, and other logical statements, and so on. Even our talk about phenomenal consciousness or what it's like to have conscious experience. Key to these recent accounts is that they nevertheless allow nondescriptive thought and talk to plug into the inferential machinery that also governs what might pass for narrowly descriptive discourse. Thus, these are not the non-cognitivist Bouveret accounts of your emotivisms that could easily be dismissed on Frege-Geech grounds. One characteristic of these newer accounts is that their notion of meaning or content is centered around inference, not reference and truth, which many of these accounts construe in a deflationary way anyway. To identify the cognitive significance of a candidate mental state is to locate its proper place in a space of reasons. To understand the meaning of a state is to know what justifies it and in turn what it justifies. My joy, for example, is justified by my seeing Siggy roll around the grass, and it in turn justifies thoughts of how significant she is to me. However, the account Furtak gives in Knowing Emotions bucks this trend. Encountering his own location problem for the alleged contents of our emotions, he casts about for the various truth makers for an individual's joy, rage, and other emotional engagements, eventually concluding that we must think about the human world as having properties that cannot be identified apart from our affective responses, 94. However, I wonder why this recent work in expressivism wouldn't just go to show how we could responsibly avoid such an endeavor altogether. And so, I wonder why we shouldn't simply pursue an expressivist account of emotions, treating them as cognitive events in their own right alongside other sorts of non-truth-aiming expressions amenable for such treatment. Indeed, it would seem to me that emotional states should serve as a prime example of experiential states that, while not themselves narrowly descriptive or truth-evaluable, nevertheless still belongs in our inferential economy. In this respect, emotions can emerge, alongside perceptual experience, perhaps, as a possible source of liberation from the ongoing tyranny of the Davidsonian dictum that only a belief can justify a belief. In short, then, much of the same considerations that drive Furtak's account lead me instead to recommend what could cheekily be called a cognitivist emotivism for the emotions. After all, what would be more natural as an account for the emotions than emotivism? While the moral emotivists of the early to mid-20th century had an insight when they likened and even identified moral expressions to emotional ones, in that both are at root non-descriptive, they underplayed the extent to which our emotional outbursts are, like our vocal outbursts, integrated into our inferential practices and are, thus, subject to rational control. They should have seen their way through to a non-descriptivism that is nevertheless cognitivist. Let me close by calling attention to a curious example from a prominent early proponent of the sorts of expressivism I've been lauding, but who otherwise isn't known for much of any work on the emotions. In Section 2 of Language as Thought and as Communication, Wilfred Sellers, 1969, identifies what has always struck me as a very odd example or rule to which he claims we are subject. One ought to feel sympathy for the bereaved. Sellers' point is that insofar as it is weird to think of feeling sympathy as an action, there must be rules, which he calls rules of conformity, that do not specify what one ought to do, but rather how one ought to be. When Siggy is gone, it is reasonable for me to expect those who claim to be close to me to feel sympathy and not just exhibit forbearance. Sellers' ultimate aim is to show how rules for linguistic and intellectual activity come to us initially as rules of conformity and not action, and that it is primarily up to others in our rule-abiding communities to ensure our conformity to these rules. For our purposes, however, the thing that is so interesting about the example is what it reveals about our feelings, including the emotions. For Sellers clearly believes that our feelings are not just bodily eruptions that intrude upon our consciousness. Though to some degree primordial and involuntary, they nevertheless can and need to be brought under rational control and geared into the rest of our norm-governed social practices, including especially our cognitive activity. In that respect, Sellers is on the same page as Furtak. It's just that the Sellersian doesn't think we thus need to see emotions as thereby aiming at accurately portraying any independent realm of axiological truth. Article 4. What are emotions for? From Effective Epistemology to Effective Ethics, by Francisco Gallegos. In Knowing Emotions, Truthfulness and Recognition in Effective Experiences, Rick Furtak defends a bold thesis that emotions are indispensable to our capacity to recognize the importance of the things we encounter. Emotions, he says, embody a kind of understanding that is accessible to us only by means of our effective experience. Specifically, it is only through the emotions that we are capable of recognizing the value or significance of anything whatsoever. Furtak, 2018-3. Yet although the book presents a lively discussion of the recognitive capacity of emotions, it does not offer a clear explanation of what exactly it would mean for an emotional response to get things right, as opposed to being mistaken or off target, nor does it provide any criteria for adjudicating the fittingness of a given emotional response. The reader may thus be left to wonder, What does it mean for an emotion to successfully recognize something about a given situation? And how we ought to determine whether a given emotional response is fitting or a cognitive? In what follows, I present an exploratory interpretation of Furtak's project that F. ills this apparent gap in his account. I argue that while Furtak does not provide and does not aim to provide guidance for determining whether a given emotion is accurate with regard to how it construes its object, we can clarify and enrich the concept of emotional recognition in ways that are suggested by and compatible with Furtak's discussion of effective epistemology. According to conception offered here, emotional recognition, i.e., the success of emotion in recognizing real features of the world, can not only be evaluated with regard to the accuracy of the emotional response in question, but can also be assessed along three dimensions that I call specificity, depth, and balance. If this turns out to be a helpful way of thinking about emotional recognition, it suggests that emotions not only aim for the truthful recognition of reality in a strictly epistemological sense. In addition, emotions implicitly point us toward a quasi-ethical ideal of responding emotionally to what we encounter in ways that are specific, deep, and balanced. As we will see, however, this ideal of emotional responsiveness is fraught. Emotional recognition and accuracy. In Knowing Emotions, Furtak is determined to show that emotions can constitute a form of knowing. He hopes to rescue emotions from the all-too-common attitude that emotions are inherently misleading and distorting, and that genuine knowledge belongs to those with stoically cool heads. And so, he consistently defends emotions from claims that they are irrational and tend to lead us to construe situations in inaccurate ways. In this spirit, Furtak picks apart some of the stock examples of so-called recalcitrant emotions and phobias, such as being afraid of flying despite knowing that planes are safer than cars, arguing that such fears are, in fact, rationally responsive to real dangers. After all, planes can do crash, Furtak, 2018, 54FF. Likewise, in his discussion of the view that moods have no intentional object, i.e., that moods are not about anything, or are merely somatic, Furtak argues that in most cases moods are in fact attuned to real features of the situation, and he concludes that the burden of proof should be on the skeptic. That a mood is about nothing should not be our default assumption, he says. Instead, we ought to assume that moods are a cognitive, Furtak, 2018, 169. In his enthusiasm for revealing the epistemic value of emotions, however, Furtak avoids addressing the ways that emotions can be misleading, and he uses words like recognize and discover without giving much consideration to the fact that they are success terms. You can only be said to have recognized Antonio Banderas in the crowd if the individual in question really is Antonio Banderas. Because of Texas' little interest in exploring the possibility of emotional error, readers are left to remind themselves that when Furtak writes sentences like, emotions embody a kind of understanding, he must mean that emotions can sometimes embody a kind of understanding. Nevertheless, I believe there are resources in the text for constructing a clearer and richer account of emotional recognition. Let us begin by considering the question of the intentional object of emotions. What are emotions directed toward on Furtak's view? What is it exactly that emotions are supposed to be able to recognize? Although Furtak does not provide an explicit statement of his view of the intentional object of emotions, he argues that in experiencing emotion, we thereby become aware of how something is meaningful or significant to us, i.e., we become aware of how that thing might be meaningful or significant to us if our emotion response to is fitting. Furtak, 2018, 82. In one passage, Furtak articulates his view this way. In what we see and in how it appears to us, features of the world are discovered, e, might be discovered, through our emotions. Every time we walk down the street, look at the news headlines, or enter the grocery store, our consciousness is drawn toward whatever seems to be significantly dangerous, calming, or wonderful. The stray dog approaching us, or a report of a political tension that is eased, or sunlight from behind a cloud that suddenly illuminates the contours of the canyon in which we are hiking. Furtak, 2018, 111F. Such passages suggest that on Furtak's view, emotions are directed toward the evaluated properties of things, items, people, events, situations, etc., such as the dangerousness of the stray dog, the relieving quality of the news report, and wonderfulness of the breaking sunlight, described in the passage above. To explain, consider that things have both non-evaluated properties and evaluated properties. a non-evaluated property, is an aspect or feature of an object that has no intrinsic relationship to a person's concerns. As Robert Roberts puts it, the term concern refers to the broad class of desires and aversions, along with the attachments and interests for which many of our desires and aversions derive. Roberts 2004:142. For example, an object's mass or velocity can be described in abstract mathematical terms, without reference to a person's concerns. In contrast, an evaluated property could be defined as a relationship of relevance that a thing and its properties have or could have with respect to a person's concerns. For example, an approaching dog would have the evaluated property of dangerousness if the dog could attack and thereby become relevant to a person's concern for safety. If it is indeed Furtak's view that emotions are directed towards such evaluated properties, then we can offer on his behalf a relatively straightforward account of the accuracy of an emotional response. An emotional response to something is accurate if the thing really does have the evaluated properties that the emotional response is purporting to recognize. For example, if the thing we are afraid of does not, in fact, pose any threat to our safety, then fear would constitute an inaccurate construct of the situation, and to this extent it would be an inappropriate emotional response in this case. This account of the accuracy of an emotional response would still allow Furtak to defend the bold thesis at the heart of his text, that experience and emotions is necessary for gaining knowledge about the significance and value of things. As Furtak points out, for example, although many of us would say we know what death is, there is a sense that we do not really know the significance of death until we have allowed ourselves, or have been forced by circumstances, to relate to it in an emotionally engaged way. Using the terms I am suggesting, we might say that this is because genuine knowledge of the evaluated properties of death, such as its tragic or frightening qualities, is partly constituted by emotional responses that are directed towards such evaluated properties, such as grief and angst. Insofar as a non-emotional or merely intellectual way of grasping such evaluated properties does not rise to the level of genuine knowledge, Furtak 2018:78ff. Without evaluating Furtak's argument for this claim, the point here is that the account of emotional accuracy I have sketched would not rule out the idea that experiencing emotions is necessary for knowledge of evaluated properties. It merely clarifies that experiencing emotions is not sufficient for such knowledge. The interpretation of Furtak's view I have offered can also illuminate some other ways that emotions might generate knowledge. Namely, by focusing our attention on the things and properties that are relevant to our concerns, emotions establish conditions that are practically conducive to gaining knowledge about a number of other things that we might otherwise have been oblivious to, including the existence of things, e.g., when on a hike, we might not have noticed a bear cub standing in nearby brush. If we had not been frightened by another bear approaching us on the trail, prompting us to scan our surroundings, the non-evaluated properties of things, e.g., if we were not frightened in this way, we might not have noticed how a backpack size and weight allow it to be used as a shield or weapon. Features of ourselves, e.g., likewise, we might not have noticed that what we are willing and unwilling to do in order to protect ourselves, or how much we care about the person we are hiking with. In theory, we could gain knowledge about these kinds of things without the aid of emotions. In contrast to knowledge of evaluated properties, these varieties of knowledge are, presumably, not inherently emotional in nature. But by prompting us to direct our attention in the relevant ways, emotions often establish conditions that are practically conducive to gaining such knowledge. And in these cases, emotions can be said to generate knowledge indirectly. Emotional recognition and specificity. If my rearticulations of Furtak's views are on the right track, more would need to be said about how we might determine whether something actually has the evaluated properties that are attributed to it in a given emotional response. However, I will leave that issue to the side in order to explore three intriguing dimensions of emotional recognition, beyond accuracy, that are suggested by and compatible with Furtak's discussion of effective epistemology. First, success in the recognition of an evaluated property may be assessed in terms of the relative specificity of the recognition. Consider the following example. An actor experiencing stage fright perceives a waiting audience as being threatening and liable to become hostile and critical, while in fact the audience is content and generous and unlikely to react negatively to the performance. Some might be tempted to view this example as a case in which the person is construing the situation in a way that is simply inaccurate in the sense that the emotion in question fails to recognize any real features of reality. But in the spirit of Furtak's defense of the epistemic value of emotions, we might pause to consider the possibility that the emotion is in fact responding to an evaluated property that is present in the situation in some form or to some degree. But in the example above, what could this emotion be recognizing? Perhaps the actor with stage fright is recognizing the threatening nature of audiences in general. It is true, after all, that audiences can be brutally critical in ways that are painful and do lasting damage to a performer's vocation. If so, then when the actor fearfully construes the audience as being threatening, there is a sense in which this construal is accurate. Not because there is anything particularly threatening about these specific audience members, but because in their more abstract role of the audience, they do or could pose a real threat. A better way of assessing the epistemic value of this emotion, then, may be to focus not on the question of accuracy, but on the question of specificity. When a person is responding emotionally to something's evaluated properties, is this response direct toward the thing in an abstract way, merely construing it as a representative of a more general category or role, or is the emotion directed toward the concrete thing in its particularity, such that the emotion is responsive to what makes the thing unique? It seems that success with regard to emotional recognition is greater to the extent that this recognition is more specific. For example, if you love me or hate me merely insofar as I am a representative of a general kind, e.g., a man or an academic, then your emotions are not as successful in recognizing me in my particularity. In this case, rather than criticizing your emotions as being mere projections, which implies that they are inaccurate and have no basis in reality, thereby dismissing in advance the possibility that your emotional responses are tracking real features of men or academics in general, it would be more helpful for us to criticize them for being directed toward mere abstractions. Emotional recognition and depth. Another way that emotional recognition might be assessed is in terms of the depth of the recognition. As I define this concept, we can say that the recognition of an evaluated property is deep to the extent that the recognition manifests itself in a relatively intense and coordinated manner along every dimension of our emotional agency, including cognition, language, perception, bodily feeling, motivation, and action. Typically, emotions manifest themselves in all of these ways. When we are afraid, for example, we are disposed to think, speak, perceive, feel, be motivated, and act in ways that reflect our fear. But in many cases, emotions do not manifest themselves along all of these dimensions with equal intensity. And in some cases, some of these dimensions are absent altogether. Point one, for example. We may cognitively and linguistically assent to a proposition such as, I am in danger, without feeling fear or being motivated to respond in the relevant way. Alternatively, we might experience a free-floating, anxious feeling without being able to think or say what the object or cause of our fear might be. Thus, emotional recognition, e.g., of the dangerousness of what we are encountering, will be less successful to the extent that the recognition is merely intellectual or characterized by other discontinuities in the emotional experience, and it will be more successful if the emotional recognition in question resounds throughout one's entire being and reverberates to one's very core as a person. When we encounter the beauty of the night sky, the scariness of death, or the offensiveness of oppression, we can be said to fully and truly recognize the beauty, the frightfulness, and the offensiveness of these things to the extent that our emotional response resounds and reverberates to our core, and thus flows unobstructed and wholehearted from our deepest concerns through our cognition, language, perception, bodily feeling, motivation, and action. One objection that might be raised to the suggestion is that such an intense emotional reaction would be overwrought and inappropriate, and so unfitting in many cases. Consider the following examples. Example 1. When at a restaurant, I am fairly hungry and find it annoying that I have had to wait for 10 minutes longer than expected to receive my order. Example 2. When at a park, I sit on the grass to enjoy the sunny day, but the grass is damp, and I find it somewhat unpleasant for my pants to be wet. What is required to fully and truly recognize the annoyingness of having to wait for food or the unpleasantness of wet pants? Given the fact that these evaluated properties do not seem very important, it seems that it would be inappropriate to give oneself over to a passionate emotional response to these aspects of the situation. For example, by yelling at the waiter or bawling about our pants being wet as a toddler might do. In response to this objection, I would agree that there might be reasons not to act out in inappropriate ways in response to our recognition of the evaluated properties in question. Nonetheless, it does seem that in order to fully and truly recognize what is annoying or unpleasant about these things, we need to allow ourselves to respond emotionally to them in a wholehearted way. I have in mind here teachings about mindfulness in the Buddhist tradition, where we are encouraged to open ourselves up fully to our experiences, even when they are unpleasant, and to let go of our resistance to what is showing up for us. If we were to attempt this kind of mindful contemplation of the annoyingness of waiting and the unpleasantness of wet pants, we may very well report that the exercise allowed us to know these qualities much better. We may even say that although we had experienced annoyance and unpleasantness in the past, we never really knew them before dwelling on them in this way. Interestingly, certain features of a person's psychology might make it more difficult to experience deep emotional recognition, as I have described it. In particular, if a person's concerns are incoherent and disconnected from one another, this might make it more likely for them to experience discontinuities in their emotional experience, and thus more likely to recognize the evaluated properties they encounter in a merely intellectual way or in a similarly deficient mode. In comparison, we can image a person whose concerns are organized neatly into a coherent hierarchy, where all of their various interests and attachments directly reflect a small set of core concerns. Such a person would find that all of their emotional responses reflect their core concerns, and thus free from internal conflict with regard to what they care about, they will be wholehearted in their emotional responses. Such a person would be better poised to fully and truly recognize the evaluated properties of what they encounter. One question we may have here, however, is whether this ideal of depth conflicts with the ideal of specificity described previously. In many cases, a deep and passionate emotional response to something arises when we construe that thing as being representative of a more general category that we care deeply about. After all, few of our core concerns have very specific content. Instead, most of our core concerns are rather general in nature, such as our concern about being safe and secure. Is it possible to respond emotionally to something in a significantly deep way while also responding to it in its specificity? If so, how? Emotional recognition and balance. Finally, emotional recognition might be assessed in terms of balance. As I define this concept, the emotional recognition of something's evaluated properties is balanced when the recognition of a particular evaluated property is contextualized by the recognition of other evaluated properties a thing has. For example, in order to truly and fully know death, or to truly and fully know a person, one cannot simply know one or a small set of their evaluated properties, even if one's knowledge of these evaluated properties is specific and deep. Furtak addresses this issue when discussing a way that moods filter our evaluated perception, allowing us to perceive only the evaluated properties that fit with our mood. In response, Furtak says, "What would make this a flawed epistemic outlook would be if the things that become salient while in the mood were the only truths about the experience. That the person in question ever felt aware of, just as a sad person would be in a deplorable condition if her affective disposition prevented her from ever perceiving anything besides what further reinforced the prevailing sadness." Furtak, 2018, 171. In several places in the text, Furtak celebrates the idea that to truly know something, we must experience in a wide variety of moods and thereby come to recognize its many evaluated properties. By doing so, our emotional recognition of the object's significance will become more balanced, and in being more balanced, our recognition of the object will be improved. As Furtak describes it, balance in our emotional recognition of an object's evaluated properties is something that is gained over time, diachronically, as we return to the thing in question in different moods or in moments when one or another of our concerns are prominent for us. But it seems it would be even better if we could somehow recognize the many evaluated properties that a thing has synchronically, i.e., all at the same time. This kind of synchronic balance is made difficult, however, by obvious limitations of our psychological capacities. It is often exceedingly difficult to respond emotionally in an intense and coordinated way to opposite evaluated properties at the same time. For example, to fully and truly recognize the tragic and frightening qualities of death at the same moment, that we also fully and truly recognize its beauty and its generosity. In this way, the ideal of balance seems to conflict with the ideal of depth. Despite the ways that the three dimensions of emotional recognition that I have described, specificity, depth, and balance, may conflict with one another, taken together, they point toward a fascinating ideal of emotional agency. Imagine an emotional agent who responds emotionally to the things they encounter in deep and wholehearted ways, while at the same time responding to them in their specificity and in their full complexity. What would be required to develop our emotional agency to achieve this ideal? Or would this ideal only be realizable by some sort of sage who has transcended our ordinary human limitations? Whatever we say about this question, it seems clear that insofar as a person's emotional responses can be criticized for lacking specificity, depth, or balance, that is, insofar as we can say that emotional responses lacking in any of these qualities will fail to fully and truly recognize our object, emotions do not merely seek to be true in a strictly epistemological sense. In addition, as emotional agents, we are implicitly called upon to live up to a quasi-ethical ideal of responding emotionally to the things we encounter in ways does them justice and gives them their due, so to speak, by responding to them in ways that are specific, deep, and balanced. Article 5. Knowing Emotions. Replies to D'Souza, Bisecker, and Gallegos. By Rick A. Furtak. Response to D'Souza. Ronald D'Souza, whose work I quote throughout Knowing Emotions, has called emotions Janus-faced, because they face both inward and outward, revealing truths about oneself and about one's world concern at the same time. I appreciate that he agrees, for the most part, with my major line of argument, and he gives me a chance to say more about a few things. First of all, why I don't identify my approach as an enactive one, although I acknowledge that there is an affinity between enactivism and my emphasis on unified, embodied experience and upon what might be called operative intentionality, it seems to me that in order to accept this term, one must do it quite religiously, that is, judging from the spirit in which others embrace it. D'Souza mentions, for instance, the enactivist activist Giovanna Colombetti, who in her book The Feeling Body, Colombetti 2014, seems to preface nearly every claim with a phrase, from an inactive standpoint. I do cite her at least 8 times, mostly in agreement, but I have some qualms about the sense of behaviorism that attaches to the inactivist stress on action and the way that it stands opposed to what I think is a crucial feature of emotions, namely their passivity. For we are moved or affected when we become emotional. Passion is not an active or enacted mode of experience. As for its unity, I think it's important to be phenomenologically accurate. If I am describing my visual perception of a house, rather than artificially dividing this experience into 2 parts by claiming that I see a flat surface and then infer that the building is other sides, I should instead capture how I view the house as having rooms that one could enter or as having depth behind the front that faces me. And likewise with emotion, Marcel's feeling of grief just is his recognition of his grandmother's death in its full significance. He is not undergoing worldless commotion combined with thought that arises after his bodily changes. In Knowing Emotions, what I have to say about action tendencies is this. It would be inconsistent not to feel motivated as if to get away from an apparent danger, since we are moved with an awareness that it threatens us in apprehending it as fearsome. If we had ancestors who could dispassionately judge that they were facing something dangerous without feeling moved to avoid it, then they were afflicted by a kind of practical irrationality which probably rendered them unfit to survive, key 64. And I add that when we detect a potential threat in our environment or a sign of danger, our body mobilizes its resources to respond. In some cases, the best response is to turn and run away, but in other cases, doing something when frightened can mean pressing the brake pedal or reaching for phone to make an urgent call, key 76. This, in fact, is one main reason why I say that what we come to know through our emotions could not be adequately grasped by any other means, key 103, in a passage that D'Souza cites. Now, I do admit that people with diminished amygdala function can sometimes learn to make intellectual inferences about nearby danger without feeling afraid, even if this is a poor substitute for the effective capacity to respond that most of us depend upon, key 75. Yet I note that there is much evidence which indicates that a deficiency of emotional feeling can be severely incapacitating. Key 119. Marcel's awareness of what it means that his beloved grandmother is dead is born in the instant that he is powerfully moved with grief. He may be akin to Frank Jackson's Mary, Jackson 1986, in that he now knows what it's like to grieve, but more importantly in this moment, he knows that he has lost someone who was precious to him. What he feels is very much about the world. It is not a mere interstate, nor did he know, perfectly well beforehand the significance of her death. He only sort of knew it. Again, the intentional content of an affective experience cannot be disentangled from how it feels. Read Key 85. If you tell me a funny story, and I flatly reply that I find amusing but am not amused, then my statement is undermined by what I do not feel. Read Key 93. Likewise, to find a work of art moving is nothing other than to feel moved by it. Now, the portion of D'Souza's comments that I want to dwell upon the most is what he says and asks about my concept of the emotional a priori, for I am well aware that this is a notion that ought to be developed further. What do I mean in describing love, care, and concern, as well as interest, as affective dispositions that have a foundational place, key 108, in our emotional life, mainly that they are in place prior to the experience of emotional episodes? As I say when I am introducing the notion of the emotional a priori in the fifth chapter of Knowing Emotions, only if we already care about the life and well-being of a person, whether oneself or another, are we disposed to react with fear when that person is threatened, KE 112. Our care establishes a framework within which the potential threat has meaning and relevance. It is presupposed as a background in terms of which our fear arises and makes sense, and without which it would not be intelligible. To shift the example, imagine that I become furious with anger upon seeing someone take out a multicolored cloth and begin applying paint to it. Incomprehensible, that would be, until you factor into the equation that I love my country and that it is a U.S. flag on which a swastika is being painted. Otherwise, someone deciding to paint his own rectangular bit of cloth would not have such power to affect me emotionally. In expanding upon the notion of love that is pertinent to the emotional a priori, I cite Ortega, who writes that when we love, our affective regard flows in a warm affirmation of the beloved, adding, think what it is to love art or your country. It is like recognizing and confirming at every moment that they are worthy of existence, key 126. It is, I note, taking an interest in their well-being, having a concern that their lives be going well. Quoting Kierkegaard, I say that to love someone or something is to will to exist, for that being key 134. Of course, I can have a passing romantic desire for someone whom I find attractive when I'm out walking in the park, but this need not meet the criteria for love in the sense that I am talking about now and that I define in my book. Love, then, is an intense form of caring, key 125, and the role it plays in demarcating and organizing our world of concern is presumably what D'Souza himself has in mind when, in a line of perfect iambic pentameter, he claims, unless you care, your life will be a mess. I might add, an empty, disorienting, meaningless mess. The way we are disposed to respond with particular emotions in particular situations is a function to cares and concerns that are always already there. Response to Bisecker. David Bisecker volunteers an evidently more plain example of emotional knowing. So in comparison with that, let's take a look at one of multiple examples from proofs that I use, indeed the one on which I rely the most. I actually think this narrative and Bisecker's have a common thread, as I will explain in a moment. Sometime after his grandmother's death, the narrator of Proust's novel returns to a vacation spot where he had customarily stayed in a room next to hers. Making a familiar corporeal gesture, he leans forward and begins removing his boots. Then all of a sudden, he is inundated with emotion. I was shaken with sobs. Tears streamed from my eyes. It was only at that moment, more than a year after her burial, because of the anachronism which so often prevents a calendar of facts from corresponding to the calendar of feelings, that I became conscious that she was dead. It is important that in a sense the narrator had already learned of his grandmother's death a while back. Here, a significant fact existed prior to being recognized to the character's emotion. Thus, the significance was not constituted by Marcel's emotion of grief. Marcel also claims that only in this moment of overwhelming emotion does he become conscious that his grandmother was gone. The embodied upheaval of his grief just is this recognition. This is also why we must reject any theoretical account of emotion which claims that Marcel already knew perfectly well of his grandmother's death and that the experience just described is epistemically insignificant. Likewise, when a mortal being whom we love is still with us, whether it be a friend, relative, or pet, we are sometimes moved to feel how much we would miss them if they were to pass away. In this respect, Bisecker's example is quite a bit like the one I borrow from Proust. Both are typical in that what we often become aware of in experiences of affective recognition are facts that are quite banal, that the summer is ending, that we miss a friend who is now distant from us, even that we're not as young as we used to be, which is trivially true. It's just that prior to the emotion in which this fact truly sinks in, before it strikes a chord with us and resonates deeply, we knew it in such a way that we were not fully conscious of it. As I say in the book, if we never felt agitated emotionally by the awareness of mortality, our own and that of our loved ones, then what we know about death and what it means to us would be less than what we do know after experiencing the relevant emotions, and what we are most intensely conscious of when we do feel so moved. The fact that all human beings are mortal and what follows from this were part of our stock of knowledge, but to use an inelegant phrase that expresses a point well, we were not knowing these things an instant before we became emotionally affected, key 80 to 81. But I disagree with Bisecker's suggestion that our emotions may constitute significance. The reason why he feels a sense of how important his dog is to him is because she indeed is. The emotion registers a certain state of affairs about the pet's importance to the person. It responds to this state of affairs, but does not create it. It's imprecise on my account to say that our lives are meaningful because of our emotions or that emotions give meaning to life. Read key 112. So, I think Bisecker places too much stress on rational control of emotions. As John Elster has written, it is precisely because people cannot decide to believe that they cannot decide which emotions to have. We can lie to ourselves by misrepresenting the truth of the matter. In the words of Freudian thinker whom I cite near the end of my book, KE 195, pretending that a slight or disappointment isn't genuinely painful when it is, or denying that we love someone whom we do, may culminate in a complex of denials strung together until we no longer know how we feel or what we believe. For reasons such as these, I do think that truthfulness is importantly at stake in our emotions. Response to Gallegos. In turning to the last set of comments by Francisco Gallegos, I must remark that I am impressed by the implications he has teased out of my argument, along with the additions and enhancements he has made, which exceed anything that I myself articulate, but which I am for the most part happy to affirm. Speaking about the recognition of what he names evaluative and what I would prefer to call axiological properties, Gallegos invites me to agree that recognizing qualities that are valuable, significant, or meaningful is necessary and sufficient for emotion. And I think I'm willing to accept this, provided that we stress the embodied nature of that recognition, without which the revelation of value is not made. As for the properties of things that move us, I accept that there may be indefinitely many valences in a single object, but I reject the notion that there are infinitely many which would be required in order for every emotional response to track accurately some feature of the object. Take, for example, my anger at the ostensible car thief, when I mistakenly believe that my car has been stolen and there is no such thief. Red key, 8-9. I would not say that this emotion is at all in touch with the world. Yet I see Gallegos' point that any object must have indeterminately many, in his terms, innumerable axiological properties. Let's say that there are hence a plurality of legitimate emotions to feel about a particular thing that moves us. How, then, can we justify any one effective way of responding? I believe that Gallegos helps me to answer this question when he volunteers a criterion of specificity of recognizing, for instance, a person in his or her distinctive concreteness. In the book, I do say that our emotions constitute a mode of cognition which is discerning and highly specified, key 88, and I repeatedly cite Iris Murdoch, Red E.G., K134-139, to identify cases in which we fail to see the distinct individual because we're enclosed in a fantasy world of our own creation, as distinguished in a fair and charitable attunement to a person that allows us to see her as she truly is. The concrete particularity of an individual personality is precisely what we love about a person when we have a specific affective sense of who they irreplaceably are, Red Key 144. What Gallegos' comments prompt me to add to what I've already said is that we rightly make similar distinctions when we talk about works of art. For instance, kitsch or art that tend to evoke a sentimental, generic response often traffics in abstractions, stereotypes, and two-dimensional characters, lacking complexity and tugging on our heartstrings in predictable ways. Our emotional life, and therefore our sense of reality, would be profoundly lacking if we were confined to such nonspecific emotions, especially when we're dealing with actual people. I also like Gallegos' suggestion that we understand full-blooded, wholehearted emotional responses in terms of depth. Marcel, for instance, may indeed fully and truly recognize the sadness of his grandmother's death only when this emotional recognition resounds throughout his entire being and reverberates to his very core. Only at this moment, as Proust's narrator explains, does he learn what it means that he has lost her forever, a year after her burial. Obviously, I do not think the embodied feeling of being literally, viscerally shaken is epistemically relevant, nor is a gratuitous epiphenomenon. Rather, it is a world-revealing mode of experience. And this is what Gallegos is describing when he speaks of deep emotional recognition. By the same token, he makes some brief yet intriguing proposals about why a person might encounter obstacles to undergoing this kind of experience. I would speculate that one barrier of profound affective upheaval is a semi-conscious terror of finding out what one deeply feels. Call this a dread of one's own emotions, 17, and of what they might reveal. Finally, Gallegos points out that I continually put forward the idea that to know something truly, we must experience in a variety of moods and from diverse affective standpoints, thereby coming to recognize all of its axiological facets. The multifaceted world of value in which we are emotionally involved, which is emphatically not a neutral realm from which we are passionlessly detached, seems to demand a multitude of emotional angles of approach. Yet he also brings up a problem with the ideal of recognizing many evaluated properties at the same time. It is not possible to respond with intense yet contrary emotions simultaneously, and this places a limit on the ideal of balance that Gallegos mentions. I must admit that this is a matter about which I also have ambivalent, conflicting feelings. What I say in the last chapter of Knowing Emotions is that because there are indefinitely many plausible, effective interpretations of anything that moves us emotionally, we might wish to agree with Nietzsche that the more effects we bring to expression, the more eyes, different eyes we bring to bear on the same thing, the more complete will be our concept of that thing. 18, however, I nonetheless question whether this makes good sense for each of us, and recommend that it is more plausible when conceived as an ideal toward which we might strive collectively, K. 185-186. Since every one of us can know only so much of what is emotionally knowable, a multiplicity of different affective subjects is needed in order to perceive more aspects of a multifaceted world. It is perhaps an unattainable goal for a finite, being to try to view things from all sides. Attempting to see from everywhere might be dangerously similar to the absurd goal of attaining a view from nowhere. On the other hand, it seems that we do broaden ourselves in a mostly good way when we are able to see and feel another side of the truth. This is something that a close friend or other loved one can assist us in doing, when by degrees we manage to see and feel things from their vantage point. In conclusion, I would like to express my gratitude to each of the four critics for their careful and thoughtful attention to my work. This marks the end of the 2019 Volume 1, Issue 1, Winter, Book Symposium, podcast edition of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion. Please join us again for our next podcast edition of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion.